The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you. Thank you, Martha, for that introduction. And, of course, I want to thank you, Gil, for the invitation to teach here. I have taught at IRC, and I've been here a few times on Wednesdays, but not way before the pandemic. So it's good to be here with you all. First of all, let's just say hi to each other. So turn around, bump fists or elbows or whatever feels safe to you. Say hi to each other. Sorry, I'm sensitive, so getting a little bit of dripping here. I apologize about that. And not because I'm Zen, but feel free to turn your chairs to face directly so your neck isn't whatever at the end. Feel free if you want, or bodies. I actually want to start us out with a visualization. So if everyone could close your eyes, and of course, if you know, that's activating anyway, but perhaps just keep your eyes down. All right. And then I'd like you to visualize peeling a fruit. This is an ancient meditation I've made up. So you're peeling a fruit. So really visualize it. You can feel free to move your hands while you're doing this too. Like which hand are you holding the fruit? What kind of fruit is it? And now you're peeling the fruit with a knife. So how are you holding the knife? How are you peeling the fruit? All right. Okay. Sorry, you don't get to eat the fruit in this visualization. Oh, actually, go ahead, eat some fruit. Since it's an ancient made-up one, so eat the fruit. And then whenever you're done eating or ready, just open your eyes and come back here. My glasses are fogging up. All right, and anyone want to share first what fruit are you peeling? Yes.
Apple.
Okay. Yes.
Banana.
Banana.
I did banana, apple, and orange.
Oh, you're very hungry this morning. Yeah. Okay, yes.
Pear.
Phew. I said a bear. I'm going, wow. Okay. All right. Okay. And then with your knife. All right. Tell me which way you peel the fruit with your knife. Go ahead. And maybe, in fact, everyone, maybe just do it. All right. Okay. Now I'll say a few words for those people online who can't really see us in the room. All right. I think I saw your hand first. Yeah. Uh-huh, with a knife like that. And then what do you do after you do those lines?
Slice a big section and eat it.
Okay. Anyone else?
I don't peel my fruit.
I'm sorry?
I don't peel my fruit.
You don't peel your fruit?
No.
A banana? You just eat the whole banana with the skin?
Knife, right? Like, I don't peel it ever with a knife.
Oh, with a knife. Okay. All right. Anyone else want to say? Yes. Uh-huh. Circle with an apple. Trying to do one piece?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a fun one. All right. I'll just say I made up this visualization for the beginning of one of these book. So I should say I'm here. My name is Reverend Katie Lynn Shutt. My pronouns are she and they. I live in Great and Rancheria land. Are we still on Ohlone land here?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Meant to look that up and forgot. And Gil was kind enough and gracious enough to be at bookshop with me at the one of the readings of my book back in November. Home is Here, Practicing Anti-Racism with the Engage Four Noble Truths. Oh, no, sorry, the Engage Eightfold Path. We've changed the subtitle. anyone was here for that, perchance? No one. Okay, or a few. All right. There were a lot of people there, but different people, obviously. So he asked me to come and give a talk about the book. And so this meditation or reflection, visualization, came about when I was literally peeling a mango a while back, not a few weeks ago. And I peel a mango, I'm right-handed, and I feel the mango, the skin, towards me. Right? And I had a memory about how one time I was doing that, and a white woman said to me, "That is wrong. That is so unsafe. You should not peel with a knife towards you. That sense, if you slip, you'll hurt yourself. You should peel away from you." And I was like, okay. But I continue to peel because this is, you know, how I was taught, right? Maybe I brought a little more mindfulness and carefulness to it. And then I, this time when I was doing it, I remembered that I used to have a hang out with a friend in the Vancouver, BC area, who's from Malawi. And one time when I was peeling a mango my way, she said, "Oh, this is how we peel it in Malawi." And so she took the mango and with a knife did those lines, and then with her, you know, finger just peeled it off. And so to me, it's a way of understanding how each of us are conditioned all the time. This book is basically about how we are conditioned, especially in the system of white supremacy culture, to inhabit or take certain places within the system, with oppression system in general, but very specifically about race here, and very specifically from the Asian American perspective, because there isn't a lot out there, especially in the Buddhist world, right? And so a lot of it has to do with how we were conditioned, and in our location, how then do we come to understand how to accept other ways of being or not, right? And by that, acceptance has to be some, you know, like rejection, lock the door, you know, black skull in the back or whatever. It can be other ways that are unconscious, right? Or maybe you could say more mild. All right. So with that, I'm going to And maybe I should just say, since most of you weren't at the book reading, is this book rose out of a response. The first response was in 2017. I was at a Generation X teacher conference, and another round of sexual misconduct had come to light in various Buddhist communities in North America. And so at this conference, they brought in right use of power as a restorative model. Who here knows right use of power? Okay, look it up. Cedar Barstow, really about up power and down power. I mentioned it a little bit in here. Really useful, and I really appreciate it. And yet it got me thinking that in my career in Buddhism, I've been to a lot of trainings, you know, and always something else was brought in for conflict resolution or any of that. And I was like, well, what in Buddhism can we have that as a restorative model? And so with the support of the Hemera Foundation, which is a Buddhist foundation, I've been developing the Four Noble Truths to be a restorative model. So in that model, the first noble truth, you know, in life there's dukkha, starts out with that there is harm and harming has happened. Because to restore anything, we have to begin that something has been broken, right? So much a conflict, I will say, is about defining that. I've heard of many divorces where it's defining who hurts who in what way, and then that from there, what kind of resolution. Wars are about who has hurt whom in what way. And when we can have some, in my sense, when there's conflict, when we can have some sense of, you know, where we could meet, that we could at least start to say, this is the issue that needs restoration. That's how restoration begins. Otherwise, it's just conflict. So that's why it starts with that. And then the second noble truth is usually it's, you know, their causes or the origins of dukkha. And in the engaged version, it's that understanding fully the causes and conditions for the arising of hurt and harm. So similar to the classic one, however, we focus a bit more on the systemic conditions. For instance, in racism, I know that for many years when a racist incident happened to me, mostly my response is, why are they being so mean to me? What did I do? Right? And until I took ethnic studies, by the way, I'm adopted. I'm from Vietnam. I lived overseas until I was, well, I came to the U.S. when I was 9 and a half for like a year and a half. Then I went to Egypt and didn't come back till I was a teenager, right? So I didn't understand the structure of racism in the United States. But once I understood that, then I realized, oh, it's not so personal. I mean, the effect is personal without a doubt, the impact, but there's a whole system that creates that. And so it's a systemic thing, and it depersonalizes a lot. It actually lowers my sense. Again, not that the individual impact isn't important and valid, but it also gives me this wider sense that, one, I'm not alone, and two, and that there are many pieces that come into being, and therefore there are many pieces that can rectify the issue. And essentially the premise of this book is that the second noble truth is that these are all things that were conditioned, right? That the suffering part, of course, certain things, dukkha is just part of life, but the dukkha that we can do something about is the things that we've learned, we were taught at times in a way that was understood to be for our safety or for our good, right? Our parents do that. I know in Vietnam, my mother would ask us to move aside when a GI was coming towards us, or a group of GIs. Black children of color are taught many things to be aware of around white body people, blue body or cop body people, right? So these are things that are taught. And the idea is that what is, and also white bodies are taught who might be safe to you or not, right? And so what we need to do is examine that and then think, now, is this a truth that works for me? Not only like now as in this year, 2024, but also where I live. I'm an adult now, I have more agency. So the third noble truth is, where do we find agency even in the midst of dukkha, right? In the midst of hurt and harm. And then the last, of course, is the Eightfold Path. So in this version, the Eightfold Path, I've structured them a little bit, but I'll just leave that for now, because I wanted to talk a bit about one of the chapters, about how we can restore. Maybe I'll just say, in general, the book is laid down three ways, and it parallels or it echoes what I see as three essential aspects of healing from trauma. Racism is certainly a trauma. Other oppressions are trauma. And that is, and I would say this is in general, right? Acknowledging what is the first step, again, towards restoration. So much of our practice, actually, it's the first noble truth, acknowledging what is. Now, I like acknowledging because it's not just knowledge, it's really investigating the knowledge, how you know the knowledge. And in fact, the practice instruction of the First Noble Truth is to investigate. That's why we want to be curious. We want to lean into it. We want to go and explore it further, right? Isn't that true? You come here, you think, oh, I'm going to get an instruction how to avoid my suffering. But if you stay for any length of the time, we're asking you to look at it. Sure, we give you tools, and the Eightfold Path gives you lots of great tools for how to be, to identify more and more clearly what is your dukkha, and to build the capacity to be with it. All right. Then knowing what shifts are especially needed, right? Skillful thinking or skillful motivation, skillful effort, skillful mindfulness, skillful speech are under this category. And in this book, I frame it as the first acknowledging is seeing the world as it is. Right? That's hard. Second is what the world needs now. Right? And then the third is learning how to put those shifts into practice. I think it's really Buddhist practice is not a passive practice. We do a lot of, you know, a lot of people go, oh, you just sit there. In fact, you know, when I ordained my uncle, my adopted mother's older brother, they're, my mother was already 48 when I was adopted at 8. So they're, you know, pre-civil rights generation for sure. And he came to my ordination and he was like, well, one, he said, do you guys have to chant like that? Have anyone been here to a Zen? I mean, we chant very monotone, right? And the idea supposedly is that we chant in monotone because then there's no, you know, if you chant melodically, the Buddha says supposedly, that then you start compared to each other, right? Oh, he sounds better, I sound worse, or I sound better, he sounds worse, or vice versa, right? And so it's supposedly in Zen, we just are monotone, so we don't arise comparison. And then he also said, well, you know, just you're just navel-gazing. Why are you just navel-gazing? What do you do in the world? And so it's useful, especially in restoration, that we actually put shifts into practice. It's not enough to know what is the impact of harm or to know what is your responsibility from the up power position, for instance. It's that, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to put those into effect? Right? And so here it's realizing the wholeness of the world, which is skillful. I call it enacting, which is my reframing. I think it's Kyra Jewel Lingo who said that I rearranged the furniture of the Eightfold Path to skillful enacting from action. Because to me, enacting gives a sense much more of the vow to do something. Essentially, the skillful action is the five precepts, right? And so by when we say enacting, to me, there's a vow that I'm going to do something, I'm going to put into action. And also laws and policies are enacted. So it gives it that systemic kind of framing also. And then lastly, in the realizing the wholeness of the world, is that there's skillful living. How do we use our energy, especially after examining and realizing what the shifts are? And when we do these shifts, we actually find a lot more energy. Isn't that true? Because what happens is we realize a certain thinking that we were taught, certain views that we were taught, brought with it a lot of tightness. And if we can understand and make the shifts from practice, then we find a lot more energy. And so what do we do with this energy? We keep on validating what we value and hold to be true, right? And essentially, restoration to me is that some sense of our wisdom, our values that we thought we agreed upon, like not killing, right? Not stealing, not misusing sexuality, not stealing, not lying, and no intoxicants, right? Those are the main five, right? That these are values that we hold, and how do we enact them? So that's essentially the framing of the Eightfold Path. So today I wanted to talk about skillful speech, which is in the shifting part. So this is chapter 7. Shifting speech to wholeness. I am in a practice period, a 90-day meditation retreat at a convert Soto Zen monastery where I've been living for 3 years. I'm part of the Doan Ryo, a selected group of senior practitioners who are in charge of organizing all the activities in the Zendo, or meditation hall. This position involves tasks such as letting people know when to come to meditate and how to participate in ceremonies, leading chants, and leading the serving teams during orioki, Zen formal eating in the Zendo. A white male teacher is leading this practice period. As is part of the format of any Soto Zen intensive session, each practitioner goes to see the leader of the intensive for a formal dokusan, a Zen word for a one-on-one interview about your practice with the abbot of the temple. Meeting with the leader one time is mandatory, after which it is up to the discretion of the student or teacher to decide if more meetings are needed. The format for a dokusan I have been trained in thus far was to bring in a question to the teacher that was about a teaching point, one's practice, or how practice can support a life difficulty. On this occasion, being the first meeting with this person I didn't know, I didn't have a question for him, so I asked him if he had one for me. He did. "I've been watching you. You go around looking glum a lot. What's going on?" I answered, "I'm having a lot of body issues. Some of it is overwork as head gardener the past 2.5 years, but most of it is that I'm having a hard time with the racism that's happening here at the monastery." He answered, "You need to not think about yourself so much. You should focus on taking care of others." I looked at him, baffled. I just started to share a pain that was a result of the impact of systemic oppression, and without having had any discussion with me, this is what he had as advice. I paused, then said, "You don't even know me. How can you say that? As an Asian American woman, my whole life is thinking about other people. I've been taught to always put other people's needs first. And what does that have to do with my experiences of racism here anyways?" The glum part, right? "Your practice," he says, "your practice as a Doan is to take care of the Sangha, a community of practitioners. So you should be putting the Sangha's needs first," he asserted. As he had completely ignored my point twice now, the subject of racism and its impact on me and thus my practice, I realized this was going to go nowhere, so I politely bowed out of the room. On one level, the abbot was correct. As a Doan, my role was to focus on making sure members in the practice period were taken care of around the forms, a Zen word for appropriate conduct, and the various ceremonies and skills that are part of Soto Zen practice. However, he did not act in context. His focus was limited to being an authority and thus commanding. It is true that the abbot, as the leader of the practice period, was technically everyone's boss. However, if you have a boss with whom the only interactions are about how you should do your job. How good a relationship would you have with that boss? This wasn't simply about professionalism and job responsibilities. I was trying to share how racism was impacting my ability to practice, which I would argue also had a profound effect on how well I could do my job. Because he was in a position of authority and he believed the job I had to do was what was most important, he did not listen to me and what I was trying to share. To the abbot, racism was irrelevant to my practice, and he only focused on how he thought my glumness affected my ability to do my job well. In retrospect, it's a little bit creepy, somebody watching me all this time. In the system of racism, white people's point of view is centered. BIPOC, or people of the global majority, voices and points of view are considered less than, from unimportant at the minimum to irrelevant. Also to me, there was an intersectionality of oppression in this situation. I doubt he would have pointed out to a male body that they look glum. The predominant stereotype of Asian and Asian American women is that we should always be smilingly accommodating. Additionally, he did not know me, only what he interpreted by watching me. We had never interacted until that moment. If he had been my teacher or was a person I had a relationship with, the result would likely have been different. The abbot, on several levels, ignored the context of the situation, focusing only on his authority and what he deemed important. The priority in his style of communication was not about connection or context. To live from liberatory agency and wholeness, we need to shift not just our perspective, but also the ways we interact with each other and the world. Let's explore how skillful means, explore skillful means to do so as we talk about skillful speech. So remember that the Eightfold Path, or the eight of them, are broken up into three sections, right? The first is called the wisdom section, and it's skillful. By the way, the traditional translation is right, and I did read that right is in appropriate, and that the analogy is that, you know, if you go up to a cow and you want to get milk, the right way is to pull the udder, not the tail. So that kind of right, right? That's what they mean by right. However, we tend to think of right and wrong. So that's why very popular for a while, and I think so much now, is wise, right, in terms of all the Eightfold Path. I myself like skillful because it, and I, to me, the elegance of the Eightfold Path is it actually tells you what is wholesome or skillful. Classic wording is also wholesome. And then it gives you skills to develop those. So that's why I'm using skillful for the Eightfold Path, okay? So the first is skillful view or skillful understanding, and it's very specific of the Four Noble Truths and of karma. And then there's skillful thinking is usually very classic. Intention is also, and I like motivation, because motivation for me, because thinking in Buddhism is never passive. Your thinking propels you to the next section, which is usually called the ethical conduct, skillful speech, skillful action, and skillful livelihood. And so, to me, motivation takes us into the next section. And the ethical conduct, I like to call it compassionate connection or compassionate conduct, because it's the interactive part, right? How we speak and how we interact with each other, how we live with each other. And then the last is skillful effort, skillful mindfulness, and skillful concentration, usually called the samadhi, or from Gill, I learned I have heard him say that it's actually the developmental, both the emotional and mental developmental. And it's often, well, it's put at the third, it's often considered the bridge between the wisdom section and the compassionate conduct. We use the meditative factors to reflect, right, on how the two are working out. You sit down and you think, oh, am I living in accordance to my values, my wisdom, which is really your values, right? The in Buddhism, as I understand it, the Four Noble Truths is your set of values, right, of how you view the world, and then your thinking is how you process that and how it motivates you to act in the world. So you sit down and you meditate to see, oh, is that in accordance? Or you sit down and you maybe just had a fight with somebody, and so you're, ooh, my speech, how does it, you know. Sure, we all think we sit down, and especially in Zen, we're just, you know, being with things as they are. But I know if I just had a fight, I sit down and I'm like, you know, think it through and try to, you know. So it's working out, right? So in this section, then, if we think about it not just as ethical conduct, as some kind of morality, but really how do we interact with each other, then are we enacting in a way that fosters wholeness, that fosters a sense that we're interconnected? Now, skillful speech is a great section in the Eightfold Path because it gives us very clear. It gives us four factors on how to have skillful speech. And while there are four of them, they're set up into two sets. So the classic wording is unwholesome or wholesome, right? Let's see. The classic ones are, let's see, how do they frame it? Because I rearranged the furniture there too. So let me pull up the classic for you. The classic is abstaining from lying, abstaining from speech that divides, abstaining from harsh or abusive speech, and abstaining from idle chatter. Who would like to recite those back to me? Kind of hard, huh? So I like acronyms. So I made up an acronym so we can remember them more easily. I also then put a little positive spin on it. So the acronym is TUGS. Like a little tug on your sleeve to remind you, hey, skillful speech is like this. So T is for truthful. Right? And truthfulness is very layered in context. For instance, we most often think of truth as being about facts and information. You know, we've heard just the facts, please. But facts can be manipulated or wrong, as we are hearing a lot about these days, right, and social media. Facts can deny hurt and harm. For instance, you know, around when this book was being written, when the Atlanta shooting, the spa shooting in Atlanta, and how then the sheriff, I think it was the sheriff, yep, spokesman, said that the shooter was just having a bad day. Even though 8 people were killed and 6 of them were Asian and Asian American women. Mm-hmm. So facts are not just facts. They're not really objective. And in journalism is starting to really sense that there's no objectivity because we all bring a lens. And in Buddhism, the more and more you practice, the more you realize 99.999% of the time, you are just projecting because everything is associative. We do not see this as just this. Right? What? Right? Most of us see this, and what you, most of us here who would say it in English, would say a glass. But some of you might already say more than that, you would say, oh, this is a glass mostly filled. I'm sitting here going, this is a dirty glass, right? Because I see some stuff, not in a bad way, just noticing these things, right? This is a heavy glass, I don't like this glass. It's too tall. It's too heavy. It's too whatever, right? We don't just see it as it is and leave it alone. We see it and we make all sorts of association about, oh, I have a glass just like that at home. Oh, that's a nice glass. I'll go get one. I wonder how much it costs. I wonder where they got it, right? It just goes on and on. So truth, right, is really layered. And with oppressions, truth is really that much more layered because it's about safety. I know before I came out back in the 80s, you know, on the weekend thing, you know, on Monday at work, people would say, well, what did you do for the weekend? And I, for many years, would be using the pronoun he, even though I was a lesbian, but it just wasn't safe in my places of work at times. So truth is very layered. I'm supposed to read this part. As oppressed people, we have to reflect on how we may have been taken on valuing white-centered, dominant society idea of what is considered significant truth over our own. If so, we need to work with it, shifting internalized white-centered views into ways that make sense to us in our lived experiences. Of course, we do need to be mindful. It doesn't mean we can say whatever we want at any time. Another way to put it is, how can we recenter truth to be more inclusive of our complex experiences in contemporary life? And more specifically, as oppression-liberated people. I forgot that my example is about also how, even though, you know, in the Bay Area, we think we're very open about being, you know, people being queer. And yet, in a lot of Asian American communities, it isn't always safe to be out to your family. Your family, everyone knows usually, but they don't want to talk about it. And so I know that a lot of interracial couples, that can be a real conflict. Perhaps non-Asian partners would think, well, you're not, you know, accepting me by introducing me to your family as your, you know, partner or girlfriend or whatever. See? So it's very layered. Now, tugs, we're on to you, is for uplifting. Right? And in particular in this book, I'm bringing uplifting as not only how do we talk in a way that uplifts each other, but also as we've internalized either racism or homophobia or sexism or ableism or fatism, all sorts of internalized ism. How do we work with that, especially when we're in that category? All right, G is for gentle. It's actually really hard to be gentle when you've been conditioned to be defensive. And with oppressions, we are conditioned to be defensive, all of us. Racism, right? When I even bring up the word racism, probably anybody in the room would probably start to go, because we're all like, right? And that is part of our conditioning, that we should not be talking about racism or that it's going to be painful. And this is why it's really hard to approach understanding places in which we were taught to actually not bring our attention to give it validity. Some of us don't have a choice because we lived in those areas, right? And yet, part of our practice is not only opening up to where we're unconscious about our, you know, you could say everyday suffering, our own personal generalized suffering, but it's also the specificity of our lives and the systemic kind of specificity. And so I know, you know, when I first started meditation, and I actually started out in the Insight tradition, and I went to a women of color group that was off of Spirit Rock, and for a while, and then one of the teachers said to me, oh, I want you to do metta recitation regularly, and in particular to use, say my favorite is, or this is how I always say it still, is may I know inner and outer safety. Now, safety can be in classically in metta phrases or in karuna phrases, right? But she very specifically asked me to include that as one of my metta phrases because there's obviously a lot of safety issues for me, right? And I did it, but it was very hard. And I have met many, many people of color, queers, other oppressed people, where metta is really, really hard, right? Because it takes that kind of unconditional friendliness to all that you are. Many of us sometimes think of metta as just like going, oh, be nice, but really metta is a really difficult practice. Because remember in all the Brahma Viharas, we're going to the point of something maybe simple to expanding it in all direction and all time and all things, right? And for most of us, yeah, I could be metta towards, you know, that I have a college degree, that I'm 5'5", that I'm, you know, I like my clothes today, but metta that I, you know, I don't know, maybe someone's looking at me and going like this, right? And I'm like, oh, do I have food in my teeth? Am I going to have metta towards food in my teeth right now? I'm making this shit up right now, so that's why that's a really silly example. But, you know, it's harder, right? I mean, in fact, yesterday, you know, I gave a Dharma talk, and there was something I wasn't that happy the way I said it. And this morning, in fact, was it this morning or in the car or yesterday? All of a sudden, I went, ah! And Deb's like, what are you doing? Deb's my girlfriend. And I said, oh, I was just thinking about something I could have done better yesterday, and I'm trying to uplift myself. So I'm just going, ah, right? So when I think about that, you know, this is my way of like bringing a metta to myself, uplifting myself, right? Metta's hard. I was at a 2-month retreat at Spirit Rock many years ago, and a friend, who is a queer man, a gay man, and at the end we talked, and he said, oh, I thought I would just come out so like oozy and love everyone. But he said the hardest practice he had ever done. Because the Brahma Viharas are actually purifying practice, so they bring up all the difficult stuff. Also, and I'm looking at the time, so I will move on. Metta is hard, essentially. All right, S is for significant, and perhaps this is where it relates most to the beginning story. Significant speech is communication that takes into account what is important for everyone in a conversation and is in service of connection. In the memory at the beginning of this chapter, the abbot responded in a way that was significant for him, but it wasn't significant for me. I brought up what was significant for me, but he did not acknowledge at all. A culture of domination, such as white supremacy culture, centers white people's point of views as what is important and valid. White privilege carries with it the sense that white people's point of view trump other races' points of view, and thus they feel entitled to decide or designate value to what topic carries more significance than others. A crucial part of anti-racism and anti-oppression work is to open up our sense of what is significant and valued. Our practice needs to actively and persistently emphasize becoming more aware of what is significant, in particular for other people, not just ourselves. Especially in areas where we have been conditioned by white supremacy culture to ignore, deny, or minimize race and racism. I will say in this book, I write white supremacy culture a lot. And the reason for that is that white supremacy culture is one in which it's like in the United States, I'll just say it. In the United States, it's the air that we all live in, right? It's the ground we all live in. But we don't have to act in ways that keep on promoting white supremacy culture just because, yes, I got it, right? All right. For those in dominant position, deep listening is a practice of not reacting from or centering one's point of view first and foremost. We can practice from a place of understanding that each of us inhabit our social location in the various systems of oppression and the resulting power differential each interaction carries. All right, I'll leave it at that, given the time. Thank you for your attention. I know I didn't leave time for Q&A, so what shall we do?
Feel free to leave, and if you'd like to line up to talk to you, then people have some time. We do have Dharma Spread, and I'm not sure exactly how soon that starts.
Okay.